Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us. I'm here with a new friend and guest. Clint, I hope we're going to be friends. I think we will be.
Let's go there. We can be friends.
Am I putting too much expectation on us?
No, I like it. I mean, we'll see how this goes. We'll see. Ask me that question again at the end of the podcast.
Yeah, let's do it at the end. Yeah. So Clint is an author of, dare I say, Christian science fiction. Is that an okay description of it, Clint?
Yeah, I think so. Although I actually kind of feel like a lot of my books are fantasy books, kind of disguised as sci-fi books.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. I mean, and it's interesting when you sign a traditional publishing contract, your publisher kind of chooses your categories. And I could not have more respect for my publisher. So when they say Christian sci-fi, I'm like, sounds good to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, fantasy, I think right now fantasy probably takes the cake for the biggest, the biggest market share in, in fiction, but I have a special place for sci-fi myself. But I definitely see what you mean about fantasy, because having read some of your material, it's one of those kind of mashups. It feels, I'm thinking of like riding dinosaurs, for instance, in Echo Nova. I'm like, yeah, that's more of a fantasy feel. Hey, but before we get to that, I'd love for you to just kind of give us a little bit of background. Where'd you grow up? What's your faith background? How'd you get into storytelling? Stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm born and raised in Atlanta. So my whole life I've been in Atlanta. Kind of grew up on the South Side. Grew up very, very much like the typical sort of what you would consider like the 1980s blue collar family. So it's like, the dad came home like sweat. He worked for Delta Airlines. So came home like very much like sweaty from working on airplanes. And my mom was a school teacher. Two kids, just kind of like straight out of the sitcom almost type of a thing.
Yeah.
So I was always a creative kid. The truth is, I really think my whole life I knew I was going to be a writer, and I just kind of had just sort of an innate understanding. And I even from a very young age, I was doing things like making comic books on the living room floor. And then when I got to middle school, made comic books with my friends, and we actually had an English teacher who would buy them from us. And we'd use that to we'd use that to go buy like the slush puppies like at lunchtime or something like that, which was awesome. But it's funny. It's a funny anecdote, but honestly, it's the kind of thing that, like, for a middle school kid, that can change your life. When you get that sort of validation from
sets a direction,
in an authority position. So, in terms of my faith story, though, we were kind of the family that sort of went to church like every once in a while. We kind of go through fits and starts, I guess. We'd go for a few weeks and then kind of back off, and then go for a few weeks, and then we'd be there, usually Christmas and Easter, but not even always then. Yeah. Because Christmas and Easter were also crowded,
a little uncomfortable.
But my I obviously love storytelling, but other than obviously faith and family, my other great love in life is basketball. I love basketball so much.
Yeah.
And grew up playing. And when I was in high school, there was a church that I had a few friends at that had a very serious basketball team. Oh. And they invited me to come play.
Okay.
And so, but part of the deal was to play on the basketball team, you had to attend church. I think it was like twice a month or something like that. So I started going to their youth group purely so I could, and again, I would have called myself a Christian, but I started going to that church purely so I could play on the basketball team.
Yeah, right on.
And it changed my life, and that's, I built relationships there like you do. I mean, I get what the ploy is. The ploy is, well, we're going to get these teenagers to come to play basketball, and then we'll get our hooks in them, like through being nice to them and building them up and sharing Jesus with them.
Yeah.
And it completely worked. It completely worked on me, and it changed my life. And that's where I wound up. It was in that church that I wound up getting baptized. The thing about it too, to give my parents a lot of credit, that it wasn't like he's going to church, so we'll start going to church. They only set foot in that church one time, and it was to see me get baptized.
Wow.
But anytime I wanted to go for youth group or for the basketball practice, they always dropped me off. They were always ready to take me there. So that was great. So but it's interesting though. It definitely affected my perspective, because I came to faith a little bit later in life than a lot of other Christian
authors. Yeah, what age were you there? Was that?
Yeah, so I was 16, I think, when I started going, and maybe 15.
Okay.
And then 17 when I wound up getting baptized. But
yeah,
because of that, I missed so many of what are, when I'm at like Realm Makers or something like that with all the other, you know, Christian authors. Yeah, I didn't grow up on Veggie Tales. I didn't know what Veggie Tales was. I didn't read
the Veggie Tales guys were there this summer.
Mike Naraki. I've actually gotten to hang out with Mike Naraki a little bit now.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
Did you tell him you had no idea who he was? Was that like a thing? Sorry, dude, you're not famous to me.
I just left it alone. He was the cucumber, right? Yeah, he was the cucumber.
Yeah.
I didn't go through the Narnia books until I was an adult and married.
Yeah.
So all of those things I kind of missed. And even growing up, when I did start going to youth group, we'd be sitting in youth group and like, okay, everybody open up to Proverbs. And I just kind of like look at my buddy and he would just be like, it's kind of in the middle, you know, because I didn't know where that stuff was. I would just be flipping through my Bible. I had no idea where I was going. So it definitely has impacted my perspective, I think, especially now as a faith-based storyteller, having a little bit of a different upbringing, I think, has certainly shaped the way that I tell stories. Not necessarily intentionally. I don't think about it that way when I'm trying to write stories, but it's something that I just kind of noticed that I do think I'm coming in from a slightly different perspective because of the way I grew up. Yeah.
Do you think that allows you to reach into the lives of those that maybe are similar, like culturally Christian, but
maybe
don't have the experience? Because I mean, like, you know, I grew up as a you know, a youth group kid, and I struggled a little bit to connect with. I was in public school though, you know, and I struggled a little bit to connect with the public school kids.
Right.
Like, do you think that sets you up to do something unique when you're writing and kind of producing content that way?
Maybe. I think it does. I have always been outreach minded.
Okay.
Because I'm a product of, I view myself as a product of outreach. Again, you know, I started going to church because they had a cool basketball team. You know, that's outreach. So, but again, it's not. So yes, perhaps, although it's not necessarily something that I don't think about, this is kind of a weird thing to say, but I don't think about my readers at all when I'm writing.
Yeah.
I really just try to think about the story and the best story that I can tell and that I'm trying to tell and whatever I think is cool. Now, I mean, we can't help but be something of a product of our own experiences. Now, that doesn't mean we necessarily have to be a victim of our own experiences. We can do certain things to then, you know, like, hey, I grew up this way. I wish I would have grown up that way or whatever. You know, we can take steps to sort of to reshape ourselves. But I do think, does it? I suppose so.
Yeah.
And I'm honestly not always sure for the better, because, you know, there's a lot of things too where when you write, you get very internal.
Yeah.
And sometimes you start digging up stuff and you're like, oh, I didn't realize that was there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Little quotes come out that you don't intend.
Sure. Yeah. So, and honestly too, it was, I was very grateful to be, with Enclave, which is a Christian sci-fi fantasy publisher, because I like the idea of knowing that I have other believers that almost are serving as sort of a filter, right? Nothing that I'm putting out there, they're like, hey, are you sure you want to say this to people?
Yeah.
And I got to give them a lot of credit too. There's been a couple things, especially like in Steel Fire, that I was like, boy, we'll see if they're cool with this. and they were. And I was actually surprised at the things that sort of did not get flagged. And I believe it's because of the way in which those story elements are presented. So,
Yeah, there's a lot of latitude when it's part of the story build, or it's part of the character arc, or you know, there's latitude there where you wouldn't get that if you were writing straight like Bible study curriculum. You know, it's like that's a no-go. But because your readers will encounter that in the real world, it actually is valuable to reference those types of things. So like in Echo Nova, which I reviewed a year or so ago, there was a strong theme of of kind of like this, I don't know. I think I saw another reviewer say a self-indulgent digital culture kind of a thing.
That felt like commentary on
what we're wrestling with right now. Is that type of thing intentional, or is that just sort of like, you know, it's where you're living and so it's what's coming out?
It's kind of both. Echo Nova, I think for me was, so the way that I've kind of framed my career, and this was not intentional, but the way that I've, in retrospect, I'm sort of almost framing my career so far. And I mean, yeah, my third book hasn't even come out yet, but, you know, my first book, my first book was for me, Steel Fire. Steel Fire is ultimately about a character going through a crisis of faith. Oh. My second book was more for my sons, even though when I wrote it, my sons weren't even born yet. Okay. When I wrote the first draft, at least. But it's because it was something that I was going through, which was very much a feeling that you need, that our worth is defined by our achievement and our notoriety. Yes.
Yeah, that was definitely there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that the digitally obsessed culture is very intertwined with that. You know, a lot of things that, it's like, oh, kids are just on their phone all the time. But a lot of it is because so much of it is designed to, that their self-worth is dependent upon those interactions, right? Yeah, like, sure. How many people are liking this? How many people are following me? How Absolutely. Are people engaging with yeah. this? And that was something that certainly came through in Echo Nova. And I think I was feeling it. You know, I think that at that point I had been writing books for several years, with tons of just piling up rejections.
Yeah.
And I do think that that book, there was a lot of things about that book. For one thing, I had been working on another, my trilogy that's coming out here pretty soon. Yeah. I had been working on that for a very long time. It's very in depth, a ton of characters, very involved. And after I finished working on book two of that, I was like, I need something that's fast, fun, and just simple. And yeah. that was Echo Nova.
Yeah.
So that was part of why Echo Nova is the way that it is. But also part of it, though, was I think me wrestling with understanding that your sense of worth is not based on achievement. It's not based on notoriety. Because that's what Dash believes at the beginning. He's yeah. like, look, if I'm going to make anything in my life, I got to be something. And being yeah. something means being something to other people. Yeah. And well, I do
largely
think
people that don't know him directly. I mean, you know,
right.
it's more of an right. audience rather than it's fans rather than family, you know.
Absolutely.
It's that sense yeah. of like that distant, isolated crowd, which Absolutely. We're wrestling with. I mean, we're dealing with that constantly, not just as a writer, I'm sure, but just as a human. I mean, I think everybody is kind of sure. wrestling with that weird tension that we're living in. Fast is a good word for it too, by the way. Dash is the name of the main character. He is fast. Yep. He's literally, yep. you know, you guys need to go read it so you know in what way he's fast, but that's actually a good description for it. If you want something that's, I'm talking to the audience now, I guess, but yeah. you're looking for something that's just kind of a fun, low, it's a high stakes story, but low stakes read. I mean, you can jump into sure. it. It's not part of a series. As far as I know, it's not a series, is it?
No, Echo Nova is a standalone novel. Although, yeah. if I know what the next book would be, I think.
There's
a lot left on the
bone. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. There is. Yeah. And I don't know. I know a couple things of what the next book would be, and it may not necessarily be a sequel. You know, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Right.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, hey, speaking of the work that you're doing in the fiction realm, mm-hmm. From what I understand, reading through your bio, you write other things, but that's not really what we're focusing on today. So we're mostly focusing on your fiction work. So as far as your fiction goes, the way that I've been sort of wrestling with this for a little while, that people, when they use the term, I'm a Christian writer, that word, that adjective Christian means a range of different things. And I've tried yeah. to kind of codify what is it that people mean? And it's kind of a spectrum. So, so on the one end, it just means it's clean, it's family friendly. A second point on the spectrum might be it's informed from a Christian worldview, but it's not a, you know, it's not, you know, there's no, I'll say overt Christian messaging. Right. Another approach on that spectrum would be Christian characters who speak the messaging, but the, you know, it's almost like the narrator is impartial, but the characters care. And then there's overt Christian messaging. And then I think on the far end of the spectrum would be like biblical allegory. Yeah. Or parable, you know, like long form parable. So I don't know, as far as the books you've published so far, where do you put yourself kind of in that lineup?
Yeah. And I'm stealing from Steve Lobby when I say this, because it's obviously, it makes sense that he would have thought more about sort of the question you're asking than I have. So when I heard him put it this way, I was like, yeah, that's it. You know, when people ask what makes an enclave book Christian, he would say it's the authors that do, right?
Yeah.
So, which is sort of, and I think it was kind of to your second like notch on the spectrum or whatever the right word is that I should say.
Yeah.
Which is that it's really about the worldview of the author, right? The beliefs of the author that make them Christian or not. Now, that being said, this is actually a really interesting discussion because you are making certain promises to the reader of here's what you're going to get. Here's not what you're going to get. Right.
Yeah, that's true.
And Enclave certainly does that, right? They have certain standards and practices. And I do like to joke. It's like, I thought I was compliant with Enclave standards and practices. And then I got my edits back and they were like, you can't do this part. You can't do this. And it was honestly, it was funny. Like it was good. And you know, I was like, yeah, you're right. Okay. I'll take that out. Whatever.
Yeah.
However, and I actually agree with that. And I agree too, that there's a certain, when people who are familiar with Enclave, when they see that logo on a book, there's kind of a promise that's been made to them. Here's what this is going to have. Here's what this is not going to have.
Yeah.
I do think that there is room in the market though for outside of those boundaries a little bit. And it's tricky because, you know, you certainly don't want to hide your faith from anyone, but like I'm reading the Old Testament right now and I'm like, wow, this part, some of this stuff would never
be it's raw.
Okay in one of these books, right? Because and you even mentioned like Christian allegories. I'm like, well some of those, that spectrum is almost like a circle if you go far enough,
because you're going to come back around.
You know, because I'm
maybe more like a color wheel or something.
I don't know. But because so I do think that there's room for more, because this is a question. I mean, when I was growing up, it was all about what makes a band a Christian band.
Yeah,
I
don't know. Same issue. Yeah,
right. Because people was like, so I'm in my early 40s, so like Creed was big when I was young.
Yeah,
was like,
me too.
Is Creed a Christian band? And it was like this constant debate, and we'd go to big conferences, and people were talking about this like on stage. Like, is it okay for us to listen to Creed? And it was always this funny thing, is like whatever band you liked, you were trying to convince yourself that they were a Christian band. Like, obviously we're not a Christian band. And I don't know, it's definitely hard to place that label on and to know, like, if you ask three Christians that question, you're probably going to get four different answers. But I would tend towards simply saying it's the viewpoint of the author. Now, I'm curious as to what you think about this, though. Do you think that Christian fiction, and all my Christian fiction is what people would consider clean, but do you think it all should be clean? Do you think it all has to be clean?
Yeah, I'm not so concerned about the cleanness of it, but I think I've proposed before that I think we ought to have some sort of tagging system so that we can let readers know, because really what we're really dealing with is the parental issue. So you mentioned Creed, and Creed is a good example. So I grew up in a youth group, and my mom did not want us listening to a categorically secular music. And so Creed was marketing. So it's just a market issue. You know, it's like Creed was marketing to us in a way that like Stone Temple Pilots couldn't, you know, or some other 90s rock band.
Also a great band.
Yeah. And it turns out, absolutely. Turns out
I got to meet the DeLeo brothers.
Did you really?
Time,
oh man.
Yeah. Well, I was in a band that opened for not Stone Temple Pilots, but the DeLeo brothers were in another band, like a super group thing, and I got to open for them. They were awesome.
we were great. Talk music then too. That's
absolutely
awesome. Yeah. But yeah, so I don't think it has to be clean. I tell you, I'm reading there's a writer named Daniel Gibbs. Who writes this great like military space. It's, I don't know if you'd call it space opera exactly, but well, he probably would. But anyway, it's got a lot of religious overtones, but the characters use language that would make it might make it PG-13, something like that.
Sure.
But the characters are wrestling with issues of faith. You know, they're religious and, there's a rabbi on board. There's also Christians. There's also Muslims, you know, so it's just, and so he's touching a part of the market that, I don't know, name some other, you know, very Christian like curriculum writer that is, they're just not touching that part of the market. And so what I've noticed just kind of following your social media stuff, I don't get on social media much, but I checked recently just because I thought, well, we're going to be talking. Let's see what you're doing. And I noticed you're at, let's see, are you doing the May Phoenix fan?
I did it last year.
Was that last year? Okay.
Yeah. I'm skipping this year. I'm hoping that I'll actually be back next year.
But right on. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, so that's an example. Like if you were writing Bible study curriculum, you're not going to get a spot at, you know, fan fusion or whatever it's called.
Yeah. Right.
So it opens you guys up. It opens you guys up to connecting. It's the basketball team. Let's use that as the metaphor. It's a type of basketball team, like you said. You know, it potentially brings people in. And I think of it as like the C.S. Lewis or the George MacDonald approach or the Chesterton approach, where they wrote fiction and people came and they connected with their fiction, but they also had this body of work that was like in the backlog almost. No, you almost didn't know about it, but then you go and read it and it's like, oh, these guys really care about the Bible. And so I suspect that's probably where a lot of, you know, kind of on ramping into the faith has happened, is not in the fiction parts, but in the, you know, just in the fact that as you learn about the author you like, there's, you know, there's some connection. So, I'm with you. I love what Enclave's doing. I read Enclave books but I read outside of that too. I mean, like I'm also reading secular authors, so it doesn't hurt me, you know, and I'm okay with that. Some folks are sensitive about it though. So, you know, I know there's a different range.
It takes self-aware. I want to come back to this point here in a second. I do want to say something about the conventions, because what I want to make sure that I am clear about though, and I say this a lot, I go to plenty of secular, what people would say secular conventions, where I'm fairly certain I'm the only faith-based. I won't say that I'm the only Christian there, but I'm fairly certain I'm the only faith-based author there.
Yeah,
I never feel like I have to hide my faith there ever.
Good.
And I actually have had, and I have friends there who are pagans. I have friends that I'm sure I think some of them might call themselves Wiccans. I'm not positive about that, but these are people that I'm engaging with. And I'm having great conversations with. I really am. Yeah. And honestly, conversations about faith. I didn't really know what it meant to be a pagan until I sat and asked one. And I found out, I was like, oh, I had no idea. What I learned is they're like, it kind of changes depending on who you ask.
Yeah.
I never feel like I have to hide my faith. They all know exactly what I believe.
Yeah.
But I really try to meet people where they are. And I try to lead just with love and with kindness. And I will say that I've never felt shunned. I've never felt, you know, like not accepted by anybody. It's never really been kind of a thing. I go to Dragon Con every year, and it's, you know, it's kind of the same thing. I'm surrounded by all types of people from all different walks of life. And you know, I say that because I think sometimes faith-based authors might be a little bit worried about showing who they are at those types of conferences.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you may catch one or two strays, maybe, in terms of like somebody taking a shot at what you believe. But for the most part, it's always fine. You know, if you're kind to other people, and if you're showing respect to other people, and honestly, if you're loving the way that Jesus shows us how to love in the Gospels. I mean, you know, yeah. I think it's all going to be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think what occurs to me is that, like, there's a place for all of it in the market. You know, mm-hmm. there is a place for the, what we might call worldview Christian. Yeah. There's a place for just the clean, but it's just a good story. There's a place yeah. for the allegory, you know, and it's not, sure. I don't read allegory because I know the ending. It bothers me. Yeah, I don't want right. to know, you know, I, yeah. I know where it's headed. Right. You know, and the overt Christian messaging stories, I don't always pick those up, but it doesn't mean, but for younger readers, sometimes parents want their kids to do those. And so, sure. you know, I know there's a place for each of those, you know, and so I think one thing that would kind of worry me is, like, if authors felt like they had to apologize to those who expect an overt messaging story, right. you got to apologize right. to them. But then if you felt like you had to apologize when you're at that Dragon Con, well, that's a problem too. And so right. it's almost like, maybe part of being the age we are is just being able to say what we are. It's like, no, this is just who I yep. am, and this is what I do, and that's okay. It's, you know, we don't have to apologize for it.
I think that's exactly right, and I would almost take it even further to, and part of me thinks that maybe this is just easier as you get older, because, like, yeah. just sort of the way that God designed us, it's like when we're younger, we kind of have to be more accepted because you're trying to build, like, community, and you need to try to build a family and all those yeah. kind of things. Yeah. And then as you get older, you just don't have to be as worried about what people
That's
think
a good,
about
you. I could see that. Well, I've wondered, you know, if you think about, like, in scripture, it talks about elders. It doesn't yep. say a specific age, but, like, the requirements yeah. for elders kind of put them as a little bit older. And one of the things that you see with people as they grow is they become less agreeable. You know, yeah. just you get, I don't know if it's crotchety or what, but you get more set in your ways. And we think of that as, like, yeah. a negative. But when you're trying to lead an organization of people that are broken and hurting, sure. you actually need people with strong opinions. And you need those opinions to kind of, like, butt heads and work yeah. through what should we do. And I think it adds strength as we age that we can just be like that. We don't need to apologize for who we are, and, you know, we know what we're trying to do.
And especially with when it comes to writing, I think it's really important for you to just write the story that is unique to you.
Yeah.
Wherever that falls sort of on the spectrum that we've talked about in terms of if it's more allegory, you know, if it's rougher around the edges, but maybe that's the story that you're supposed to write, and that's you're not beholden to anyone really except God. Okay.
Yeah, that's
you don't have to apologize to anyone else. Now, that's hard because you're like, okay, yeah, but I wanna sell some books. I wanna, like, make yeah. some money. And I get that. And so I'm not trying to tell anybody their business, but it was very freeing for me when I kind of started reaching a point where I was like, you know, I just want to write stories that I think are awesome, that I really yeah. like, that feel personal to me. If people like them, great. And I hope people like my stories, but if they don't, that's okay too, right? Like yeah. if I just get to write stories that I think are cool, and then I just do my thing as a dad, and if I, you know, I work a day job and all this, I'm okay with that. That's great. You know, yeah. that's perfectly fine. But it can be tough to get to that point. And I think Echo Nova was me trying to get to that point because especially when I first started Echo Nova, I think I was still the opposite. I was like, no, I've got to go conquer the world.
Yeah.
You know?
yeah.
And I don't necessarily feel that way anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it changes over time. You know, I read this thing years ago that helped me kind of relax on that front a little bit. It was that just because, I mean, like the amount of people you know personally is going to be a fairly small amount.
Sure.
And it's very possible that your interests and what you write means that the folks you know are not necessarily the target market. Like, my grandma doesn't want to know about orbital mechanics and inertial dampening.
Right.
You know, they don't, she's not going to care about that. So, yeah. you know, what he encouraged was think of it as there is an audience out there. And we are much more capable of finding them now because of the internet, but you won't necessarily see them in your own circle, you know, even right. your own, like the first few projects you do, your beta readers, it might even be hard to find beta readers that fit
right.
that target
right.
market, but you keep working and you'll find those people that care, you know,
yes.
And it just comes. So one of the things I wrote down that I wanted to ask you is, so you've got, You've got two books published with Enclave so far and a third on its way, but actually it sounds more like a third as part of a trilogy. So it's sounding like it's going to be five at some point. I'm wondering, what would you say, like if you had to boil down kind of the messaging for each of those, like what you want the, like now that it's written, like while you're writing, you said you don't think much about the reader, but now as a product that lives in the marketplace, what do you want the experience to be? What do you want the message to be? What do you want the reader to take away from each of those books?
And even that, because you phrased that a few different ways there at the end, but I would almost answer each one a little bit differently, you know? I mean, so, okay, we're kind of getting into awards season now. And I've been doing the writing contest thing for years. And there was one of the very first times I was in like an unpublished writers contest, and I was a finalist, and like we went to the big thing, and my wife bought a new dress, and it was all fun. And then I lost. By the way, I've never won anything. The dress was great. We had a great time. I've never won anything. I'm very, very good at sitting and clapping. But that was still early. That was one of my first ones. And I was bummed. You know, we went back to the hotel room, and I just remember I didn't have any like books with me at the time, and I just like picked up my phone and I was reading Ready Player One on my phone. Yeah. And Ready Player One just took my mind off the fact that I felt like I had, of course, I didn't let everybody down, but I felt like I let everybody down, right? Ready Player One took my mind off of it for a while, and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
If I just give people that, sometimes that's all you have to do.
That's beautiful. You know? Yeah.
That's great. That's good enough, right? Just to say, hey, just enjoy this for a little while, and you don't have to worry about the other things that you're sort of disappointed about. If that's all people take, just a cool story that they enjoy, great. The huge win. Now, to go deeper though, and I have a different answer for each one. So like I said, so Steel Fire was the book that was for me. Echo Nova is the book that's kind of for my sons. Worlds Collide, which is my upcoming trilogy, that's the thing that I want to say to the world. But I'll start at the beginning of this. So Steel Fire, it's weird for me to kind of even go back in my head now thinking about it, but that's about a character. It's about robots doing magic, but that's not really what the story is.
I actually have Robots with Magic written under
Robots with Magic.
Yeah. I love that.
But that's not really what the story is about. The story is about a character undergoing a crisis of faith. You know, his family is the family that that did everything the right way. You know, they prayed, they served, they fought against the bad guys. They did all the things they were supposed to do, and then they got absolutely annihilated. And they got annihilated by an army that, from their perspective, is sort of wielding the powers of God because the machines figure out how to do elemental magic. And he's the only guy that's left. My main character, Gunnar Graves, is the only guy that's left. And he's like, he still believes. He kind of wishes that he didn't believe in God anymore, but he still believes. And he's like, you know, I know I'm not perfect, but I don't think we deserved this.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us have felt that way before. You know, it's one thing when your life maybe takes a downturn and you can point at a decision that you made, or maybe even a series of decisions that you made, and you're like, well, this is kind of my fault because I did this, that, and the other thing, and I should have known.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't go that way. Sometimes there's something bad that happens. And again, you don't think that you're perfect, but you're also like, I don't know if I deserved this. This doesn't seem fair. And trying to keep hope, even in those sorts of times, and understanding that even though, and people can get into a lot of theological conversations about, you know, like does God orchestrate everything or does he just let things happen? But then turns it, you know, personally, I'm a little bit more on like, hey, God, I don't think God did this to you, but that doesn't mean that he can't use it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What's interesting though, the key message of that book is that sometimes our deepest wounds and our darkest like shames can become our greatest sources of strength, especially when we use them to help someone else.
Yeah.
And that really, again, that was not intentional when I started writing the book, but that really became the key message of that book. And what I realized too, and you kind of start thinking about it this way, and then you sort of start seeing these stories, is that God may not have caused that terrible thing to happen, but he can use it.
Yeah.
And when he does, there's actually two blessings. There's whatever he does, the blessing that comes from it, right? So this is Joseph, you know, basically becoming in control over Egypt after getting sold into slavery and then thrown in prison wrong and all these things that happened to him wrongfully. I don't think God did those things to him, but he used all those things to then put Joseph in this amazing position. Yeah. There's the blessing itself, but maybe the greater blessing is when you realize that this couldn't have happened outside of God's intervention. Like this amazing thing that has come from this. And that awareness, I think, is actually the greater blessing, you know?
That's cool.
Like there's the good thing that happened to you, but even greater though is realizing that we have a loving Father that will do things like that. Now, so that's
the blessing of belief. Yeah, it changes what you believe about God. Yeah.
Perfect way to say it. The blessing of belief.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Now, Echo Nova is a little bit lighter. You know, if I have a like, if somebody's like comes to me and says, "Dude, I just want to take my mind off my problems for a little while," I'm handing them Echo Nova.
Yeah.
Echo Nova is actually very much about empathy, and it's also a lot about our culture's obsession with fame, and how much it sort of desensitizes people. That the people that we see on screens kind of almost become like not real people to us.
Yeah.
Because we just viewed them as a source of entertainment. You know, when I was working on that book, and this was a total fluke, I wrote that book years and years ago. There was a documentary on ESPN. It was like an 8-hour O.J. Simpson documentary.
Wow.
And by the way, fantastic documentary. Yeah, I wouldn't cut a minute, 8 hours long. I wouldn't cut a minute of it. It was so good. Yeah. But when he's fleeing the police, he was driving like 35 miles an hour. And he's in the white Bronco, and there's all sorts of news coverage, or helicopters and news cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
And people are running out onto the streets and on the overpasses, and they're holding up these signs like "Run, OJ, run." And they're kind of like laughing and joking and "Look at us, we're on TV."
Yeah.
And I'm watching that in the documentary, and I'm thinking like, this guy, this is an extreme, I won't go into all the details because I don't know who's listening. But people who know this was a very grave and serious situation from a couple of different angles. And something very, very horrible could have happened at any moment during that chase. And almost did. But people, it's like it wasn't real to them. It's like the whole thing was a joke. It was like it was entertainment, right?
Yeah.
And I really got involved with that idea. So it, just for people who haven't, people who don't know, Echo Nova, essentially, it takes place in the future. Time travel has almost become sort of commonplace. It's very, very expensive. But what people do is they go to the past, and there are shows essentially that are broadcast from the past. So you might send back some of our great athletes to like battle against ancient Roman gladiators, or you might send back comedians to infiltrate fancy Victorian parties or something like that. But what they decide, because of the way, and I won't go into the whole way that the time travel works, but basically that changes to the past don't impact the present. And the reason why is because I have two principles in the books. The speed of time is constant, which means that us in the present, by the time the ripples of change from time move forward, that we've already moved on, right? So if you think of us in the present as at the tip of a stream of water, we are constantly moving forward as it trickles down the sidewalk. So as you go back through time, you change something. That change does create ripples, but the speed of those ripples is constant as well. So by the time it reaches, you know, by the time 1985 reaches 2005, the people who are in 2005 have moved on to 2025, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
which by the way, since you bring it up, I wanted to say something about this. I put this in my original review, and then there were different versions of the review that got edited down. So I don't remember if I think on the Amazon review I wrote for your book, I mentioned that I think this is I'm not the best read, but I read a fair amount of sci-fi and occasionally time travel stuff. This is unique to me. This was like, it made a lot of sense. Like there is a specific constant in the universe, and it's the speed of light.
Yeah.
And light and gravity and electromagnetic spectrum and the way that time works is all tied to that. And so it makes sense that there would be a constant at which changes through the timeline would occur. Right. I'd never heard of that, you know, and I'm making it sound like it's some kind of technical you know, astrophysics book. It's not. It's a fun, like we said, a fast, you know, but like, but there's enough in there. You seeded enough in there where I'm like, I mean, like I stopped and just kind of like, oh, great idea. And you use this idea of lily pads where it's kind of like you're jumping from one lily pad to another, but the lily pads are kind of like moving through the water because the water's moving.
Which makes them not lily pads. And I actually
they wouldn't be tight, but well, it's, maybe they got cut or something.
Sure, right.
The frogs ate them, the stems. I don't know.
Right.
But beautiful in its ability to because here's what bugs me. I tend towards like harder sci-fi, and what bugs me in some sci-fi is the author wants some aspect to be true for the sake of the story, but they don't do the work of figuring out how that could be true with what we know, you know? And so they just they go soft, you know? And I liked yours because it had a note of that kind of hard sci-fi, although I wouldn't call it hard sci-fi exactly. It's
I'm not smart enough.
Of that, you know, like, oh, this is thought out. This is well, you know, so very, very creative, very unique. Sorry to interrupt, but it was cool. I liked that.
I appreciate it. And people will have asked me a few times, like, how did you come up with that? And the real answer is, I don't really know. It kind of just sort of hit me one day.
Out of the ether.
It kind of did. I do a lot of just handwriting, like, especially when I'm world building and doing notes. And sometimes the things will just kind of come out. The ideas just come out. It's not like I was sitting there trying to think about what am I going to contribute to the genre that I haven't read before. It just sort of happened. But because those ripples don't impact the present, they sort of decide that the past isn't real, that it's just residual energy, including the people.
Yeah.
And when you decide that people aren't real, that gives you license to do whatever you want to them.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of what we see happening in Echo Nova. But when our lead character starts going back and he starts having interactions with these people, they sure feel real to him.
Yeah.
I won't give away any more spoilers from that, but that's very much what Echo Nova is about empathy for other people, like how we view other people, how I think fame and our desire for notoriety and for achievement can impact our view of ourselves and how it can also warp how we see other people.
Now,
if that sounds heavy, again, it's also just like a really fun story with dinosaurs and pirates and samurai.
Yeah, like I think if you liked Ready Player One, I think you'd like Echo Nova. It has a similar kind of feel. Mm-hmm. It's not lit RPG or anything, but it has a kind of an overlap in it. The way that you've built it gives you the opportunity to kind of see those different worlds and stuff like that. But yeah, so I think for readers of that and in that genre, would probably really enjoy it. But now worlds collide. I mean, man, this is big. I wriggled my way onto the street team. For those that don't know what a street team is, he's releasing the book soon. I think it's in pre-order because I pre-ordered it. But
it's in pre-order. Yep.
But if you get on the street team, you can read advanced copies and let people know about it, which I guess is kind of part of what we're doing right now. But anyway, so I've started to read it, but I haven't gotten very far into it yet. But I'm starting to get a feel for the different worlds. So what can you tell us? What still needs? I mean, there's probably things that still need to be a secret since nobody's read the whole thing. But
sure.
Where is it? What's the world build? What's the thought behind?
Yeah. So the basic story of Worlds Collide is that sort of it's in this fictional galaxy. That 10,000 years ago, these five cosmic creators, a dragon, a phoenix, a serpent, a lion, and a wolf, they decide to have a contest of the gods. And I probably have a little bit more time here than I normally do. The truth is, at first, they try to fight it out. And this might be the first time I've said this publicly.
All right, we're getting a little something exclusive.
Yeah, I'll release this in a different format before the book actually launches. But at first they try to fight it out because they have to decide who's the greatest among the gods, because you got to know who's the greatest, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't go so well. They're all kind of at the brink of destruction. And what they then decide is that actually the greatest test of a god is creation. So they each create their own world. And they set these worlds on a 10,000 year collision course. What that means is that if no planet does anything at all, at the end of the 10,000 years, all five planets are going to crash into each other and everybody's going to die. So the only way for you to survive, to protect your people and to win the war for your creator, is to be the last planet standing at the end of the 10,000 years. So it's ultimately just all of these planets trying to destroy each other before they all collide. So Worlds Collide, which is book one, has a character from each world, a different hero from each planet, and they're all very unique in their own ways. And all the I've never spent so much time developing a story as I did for Worlds Collide. I spent probably half a year world building and planning before I even Wow. started writing book one. And then of course I continued to do so as I was, this trilogy is over a decade in the making.
Man, for me.
Yeah. It's been the story that I've wanted to tell for a long time.
Yeah.
So
do you still remember the moment the idea hit you of that initial,
man.
What was the kernel? Was it the worlds colliding or was it the gods or?
So it was a couple things coming together. I was working on another book that is still yet unpublished. It may forever be unpublished. But the first idea was the multiple creators of different worlds. But I remember exactly where I was. I was sitting, we were living in a townhouse at the time, and I was working on my other book in my basement office. And I kind of had this idea for the multiple worlds, with each with its own creator and with them being on a collision course. And that was all I had. Around the same time, I had been reading, a book that talked about the different types of hero characters. And it was like the cunning hero, the hero with the code, you know, the winsome, you know, right, that kind of thing. And I kind of thought, it's like, you know, that'd be fun to, as a way of trying to see if I can write each of these different five hero types, map each one of them to one of these worlds.
Oh, that's cool.
And then
cool.
have that. I've done that a lot. When I used to be more of a musician, I want to write a song where the guitar just drops out in the verse. I want to see what that's like. And so I would write a song just to try to learn that. I do that a lot with writing too. So Worlds Collide kind of started off in some ways as a writing exercise of me trying to write different hero archetypes. And it's just in a sense grown from there. But the real message behind this book, and I feel like I can say this, and it's kind of obvious once you start to read it. I believe that the enemy seeks to divide us, and that the more sort of isolated we are into our, I hate that I'm about to say it this way, into our own little worlds, the more we can other people, you know, and I use other like as a verb, right? Seeing them as something different, almost as if they're like a different species or something.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened here. You know, these people, they think that obviously everyone on these other planets that they're evil, that they're monsters, that they're, and some of them kind of are. Yeah. but I see that a lot. You know, I see a lot of division. I see a lot of isolation.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when people start coming together, having honest, generous sort of interactions with each other, our feeling starts to change. And you still may not agree with people. You still may not agree with everything that they agree with, but a lot of times you can at least sort of see their perspective. And Worlds Collide is about that a lot. Now, again, there are battles to fight, but the battle lines aren't always where we think they are.
Mm, yeah.
And maybe where the enemy wants us to think they are. So in Worlds Collide, you know, as these different planets start coming close together, right? By the time book one starts, we're getting close to the collision.
Yeah.
And, you know, several of these planets have already been at war. And this is one of the first things you find out. But like, so for example, the Phoenix and the dragons have already been at war for years. And the dragons have already won and they've enslaved the Phoenix people on their own world, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, I'm trying to like say this, I'm sifting through spoilers.
Yeah, I know. Right, I know.
So I'm talking about this, but, they start to realize that there's maybe more going on here than they were originally told. I'll leave it at that. So that's sort of the setup for Worlds Collide.
You know, what it makes me think is as we get segmented, I'm stepping out of fiction world here now, just thinking about how it relates to us. As we get segmented into our own kind of like, I'll say digital echo chamber worlds.
Sure.
We sort of each create our own lore, you know, our own backstory, our own creations, origin story of why we exist and what we're doing. You see it with political parties. You see it with denominations within the faith. You see it with, you know, and And what happens is like this microscoping effect where you get focused on the minutiae of small differences.
Yep.
Rather than focusing on the vast majority of content of where we're similar, you know, sure. that we came from the same place. Sure. It's almost like we create that backstory for ourselves and our groups and our tribes so that we can continue the fight, you know. Yeah. And it makes me think, you mentioned the enemy. It makes me think in a perfect world, I don't think that would happen. I think that must be fueled by something, you know. Sure. There must be some dynamo behind that that's driving and, you know, grinding us forward. And
yeah.
obviously, you know, because I'm a person of faith, I assume that's Satan's work, you know, that's sure. what he's doing. Sure. So I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting. See, I hadn't gotten deep enough into it. I somehow missed the original email for the advanced copy. And I was actually emailing Enclave just yesterday. I was like, did I miss this? And apparently I did. So, I'm catching up now. I've just seen the opening scene of the, you know, the battle that's going on and stuff like that, but I don't want to spoil anything. And I'm sure. so ignorant of it. I would probably spoil something just by talking about it. So
no, I probably have already even said too much. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Cause
I comfort in knowing that very stuff. Few people yeah. listen to this podcast.
So. I'm sure that's not true. Come on. Yeah.
Yeah. It should be no problem. Well, hey, I thought maybe we could wrap on just kind of zooming out and just talking generally about kind of favorite things. Like you mentioned music, we've mentioned books, things like that. So what are some of your favorite, you know, favorite authors? That can be, you know, it could be Christian, it could be non-Christian. Like what's inspired you over the years that
yeah.
has just kind of fallen into the hopper?
Yeah, I mean, okay, C.S. Lewis is the obvious answer. Although yeah. I'm actually, when I say C.S. Lewis, of course I love Narnia, but I'm actually a little bit more into, especially The Great Divorce. I love The Great Divorce.
Oh, wow. Which
okay. I think about that book all the time. I revisit it all the time.
It runs through my head pretty often, especially yeah. the scene of them walking on the grass.
And yes.
painful, but also... Yes. Napoleon pacing in his little apartment in the back end of hell. I mean, it just, wow.
The
yeah.
the idea that hell is getting everything you want, basically. Yeah. And yeah. then as it happens, you become, again, increasingly isolated.
Yeah,
I think about it all the time. So very much C.S. Lewis, but that's almost like a boring answer, right? Like, yeah. because it's almost kind of an obvious answer.
Well, I'm not bored by it, but I know.
Right. I love Max Brooks. So I was actually very fortunate to have Max Brooks on my podcast. So Max Brooks, wrote, World War Z, and he wrote Devolution, okay. Zombie Survival Guide,
yeah.
And a handful of other things, but and what's funny is I don't really share his writing style at all. You know, most of this stuff, like World War Z, which by the way, anyone who's like zombie fiction fan at all, you must read World War Z. It's weird to pitch it this way, but it is exactly what would happen if there was actually a zombie okay. apocalypse.
See, I've seen the movie, but I hadn't read the book.
Oh man. The movie's fine. It's a perfectly fine zombie movie. The book is completely different. The book okay. is essentially the pitch of the book is that the zombie war is already over. And this guy's been hired by the government to go around the world collecting different perspectives on what happened because he's supposed to be writing this like global report from like what happened in all these different parts of the world during the zombie war. And he puts it together as this book. So every chapter is a different point of view. And it's incredible. It's so, so good. And the audiobook's amazing. He got like Mark Hamill is in it. And I think maybe John Bernthal is one of the voices maybe. Okay. And Martin Scorsese does one of the voices. The cast is unbelievable.
Wow.
So anyways, I love that. I mentioned Ready Player One. I love Ready Player One. That book, part of that was right place, right time for me. You know, it was kind of the story that I needed when I needed it, even though I'm actually, old as I am, I'm actually a little young for most of the references. I was too,
but I got them. Yeah. I mean, like,
I think I got them. I still haven't seen War Games, for example. And a lot of the video game references were a little bit before my time, but I love that story. And then, of course, Red Rising, which, you know, for me, Pierce Brown is the writing voice that I mean, you need to be who you are, but I'm like, man, I wish I had that writing voice. It's just so good, so poetic, so strong. And then the book that I like to shout out every once in a while, just because not as many people have heard of it, there's a book called Battle Mage by Peter Flannery, which is really cool sword and sorcery, but it's more like accessible than a lot of other stuff. It's not so ridiculously thick that you just get intimidated looking at it. And it's very just like straightforward, you know, high fantasy, demon armies come in. We need to figure out some magic. We need to get some cool weapons and we need to go fight this demon army. And I love Battle Mage. So for anyone, especially anyone who's maybe, if you're trying to sort of get into fantasy, but a lot of fantasy seems kind of like there's a steep learning curve, or if there's someone that you think would like it, but they're not into it yet, Battle Mage is like a really good like first entry into that genre. People should definitely go check out that book.
Yeah, very good. Okay, I'm going to ask you a high stakes question here related to this. So I want to preface it by saying I read, I don't know what else to call it other than secular. Like I'm reading The Expanse right now and it's fantastic. It's rough. Yeah. I'm not endorsing it for those that, you know, are bothered by, but you know, it is so well written and I feel like I can learn a lot just about the craft, for instance. So, Andy Weir's another one. I love Andy Weir.
I love Andy Weir.
I don't know what he's doing. I don't know how he does what he does, but I can't put those books down, you know?
Okay. Writing voice for him. Yeah.
So I mentioned Daniel Gibbs earlier too. I'm reading secular stuff for fun.
Right.
I often feel that I feel a little bit of an aversion to reading Christian sci-fi and fantasy. Although I don't think I felt that with what you've done, you know. I don't remember the experience like of just thinking through it like at the time, but whatever. Sometimes I feel that. And so the high stakes question is, do you read Christian writing recreationally? Because I'm finding that I struggle a little bit. I struggle a little bit, and sometimes it feels like a chore. So, like, what do you read in that, in kind of that world, in that realm?
Yeah, it gets a little bit weird once you kind of get into the industry, because some of the things that I'm reading right now, it's like I'll get asked to read something for endorsement. So is that recreational? You know what I mean? But like I read Kathy Tyre's new book, Firebreak, which is awesome.
Oh, she's great. That's an exception to what I just said.
Right.
I loved, what was the first one in her series? It was Firebird. Oh, man. So good. And so I read that and I thought, because that was one of the first when I was discovering like Enclave and I was like, oh, man, we are set. If everybody's doing what Kathy's doing.
Right.
And then I realized.
Well, no one can do what Kathy does.
Yeah, not everybody's doing. But it's not that it's all bad, all but Kathy. It's just that she is such a pro, you know. So anyway, that's a great example of a very good one.
I would throw that one out there. I tell you, I think Lindsay Llewellyn is really exciting. I don't think I've read any of hers. So it's YA. I would call it YA dystopian sci-fi. The Chaos Grid, which is fantastic.
Oh, yeah, I talked to her at Realm Makers. Okay, I haven't read anything of hers yet.
She's awesome. I actually have not read book two yet of that duology, which is called The Crier Stone. I haven't read that one yet, but I have. I also did just read, I think I'm allowed to say this, I read her new book, Karabos, for endorsement. Am I pronouncing that right? I think I'm pronouncing that right. And that actually probably skews, it kind of depends on how you want to split the difference. That one might actually skew a little bit more kind of toward fantasy. But I think that she's, this will be her third book, but I think you'd still consider her, like me, kind of a new author. I think she's a really exciting voice in that space. The other person that I want to make sure that I shout out is Stephen Burnett. I read Above the Circle of Earth for endorsement as well. And I tell you, that book, well, I remember reading that book and thinking, this book is going to have an audience. I think that book is for... Okay, let me put it this way. So when I went to World Fantasy Con, and it was the year that The Martian had come out.
Yeah.
The book, not the movie. And people were raving about The Martian at that con. I remember astronauts up on stage and they're like, this guy got the math right. He got the science right. Yeah. Now, that's not why I loved that book. I loved that book because of the sense of humor. And it reminded me of my friends who were like super into, it reminded me of my smartest friends and their sense of humor. And that's why I loved that book. I think the with like sort of the technical detail of like, this is actually what would happen from a faith-based perspective. I think Stephen Burnett nails that in Above the Circle of Earth. So I think that he's one to watch, and they've announced, I think they're doing more books in that series as well.
Yeah, I think so.
So he's one to keep an eye on as well. If you're into that, it's a little bit more of the adult side of things. But I think really, really good. But again, to say like, am I reading it for recreation? Those lines start getting blurry again because
when you're now working most, in the industry,
most of those that I pick up, I'm like, well, I know this person, and half the time it's like for an endorsement or whatever. Yeah. So,
so maybe the question would be, did it feel recreational when you got done with it?
And it did. That's like, always that's
and it sounds like you're in the right place. I mean, if you're doing it and it's fun, it's not a grind, then man, how could you ask for something better? I mean, I feel that way about, you know, on a story writing day, because I don't only write stories. I'm doing sometimes it's curriculum, sometimes it's Bible study stuff, but definitely on a story writing day, it's like, man, the fact that we get to just do this is
it's
amazing.
Awesome, right?
It's like, how does this even exist as a job? It's very amazing. But anyway,
did I leave anybody out? Who do you like? Who are you into right now?
You know, as you were talking, I thought of somebody. Oh, I tell you, Suzanne something did Waters Break. I thought Waters Break was so.
No, that's Waters Break. No, that's.
I feel embarrassed. I forgot her name. Is it Suzanne something?
No, that's...
I'm mixing her with who wrote Divergent. Here, we'll both Google it, I bet.
No, you're thinking of Sophia.
Sophia, not Susan.
Yeah, right. As I was saying, I was on the tip of my tongue. What, Sophia, yeah. Sophia's my good friend. Sophia, here's the Sophia. I'm sorry. Yes, of course, Waters Break.
Yeah, she, and especially like in the first half of that book. So this is another published by Enclave. Enclave is killing it, man. I mean, they're doing great work. But in the first half of that book, I felt like I was getting wet. I felt like I was in the water.
Yeah.
You know, the language, it was almost like she created an entire linguistic vocabulary for the, because it's a species of kind of like alien underwater aquatic people, you know? And so she created this, but it was in English. I mean, it's not a different language, but it just felt like, it's like I've just stepped into this different linguistic world. And then they come out onto the land and it's so dry and scaly. I don't know. I don't know how she did what she did. It was very good. So anyway,
awesome.
that was exciting. So it's kind of like this aversion that I used to have to reading Christian fiction. You know, I thought the only thing that existed back in the day was like Francine Rivers, basically writing Samson and David books, you know, and then come to find out there's spaceships and you know, fantasy stuff and aquatic dwelling people. So Enclave has been, and there's other publishers doing great stuff. I think Enclave is just kind of the tip of the spear right now. But I mean, am I right? I mean, that's what it feels like to me. But I mean, other publishers would you say are doing well?
Because you got Enclave, and also especially just saying the sci-fi too, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention like Lauren Smith, of course, and of course Kathy McCrum, who won like Book of the Year last year at Realm Makers. So Enclave has a lot of great people doing stuff. Candace Kay does cool YA sci-fi. Outside of Enclave, I like what Descendant Publishing is doing, and I know Troy Hooker a little bit. They're doing some, I think they're getting into a little bit more darker type stuff, but they're also doing a little bit of horror. They did, what's it called? What's the Inferno book? The book that's based on Dante's Inferno. That's,
I hadn't heard of that.
Brian Timothy. Yeah. Brian Timothy Mitchell. I want to make sure I get the name of his book, right? Infernal Fall, which read and enjoy. Actually, I did the audiobook on that one, which is read by James Rubart. But yeah, Brian Timothy Mitchell's book, Infernal Fall, is fantastic.
Okay.
And then Descendant is also getting into some of the middle grade stuff. Lindsay Llewellyn, I think, is putting out a middle grade book with them. J.J. Johnson is putting out a middle grade book with them as well. So I like some of the things that I see them doing as well. Yeah. So for people who, because the thing about Enclave is, I mean, it's still small. You know, it's only so many books a year.
Yeah.
And if you don't fall into kind of what they do, there are other publishers that I'm seeing doing some great things. And I would definitely highlight Descendant as one of those.
Yeah. But you're definitely, you know, you dance with who brung you. So
For sure.
Everything you've done is with Enclave so far, right?
Everything's with Enclave. Yeah. And I mean, I'm thrilled. I knew it was going to be awesome. And they have far exceeded my expectations.
Yeah.
Every single person who has touched one of my books over there has made it better. And that includes all the editors, but not just the editors. The interior design is gorgeous. The cover design is awesome. The marketing stuff is fantastic. Like everyone over there has.
Yeah, who did the map? The map that it opens with. I spent 2-3 minutes just looking. It's not like a complicated map, but it's got the creatures and the worlds, and I was like, wow, this is cool.
So glad I get to say the name Jamie Foley. Foley made the map. And Jamie Foley also has done, she does the interior design. I think she's done all of my books for Enclave. So not only did she make that beautiful map, but she also, anything that looks cool on the page, that's Jamie Foley's work.
Yeah. It's a neat layout. Just opening it, I'm just giving you my experience here. Even the font used for the title page, I was like, ooh, what's going on here? It kind of has this feel to it. I don't know. It's well done.
Yeah, the cover's Kirk DuPont's. Is that what you're talking about? You're talking about the cover and everything?
Well, actually, the cover's great too. I was just in the advanced copy. I was just, you know, that first title page that you come to, just the font, you know. I'm trying
they
to think
nailed
of the
kind
cover.
Of a...
The cover is... DuPont's did the cover. Let's see.
DuPont's did the cover. They nailed kind of the retro futuristic kind of a feel, but that definitely has kind of an epic vibe to it that... Again, as soon as I saw it, like I was just like, "This is awesome!" I was so thrilled with it. So again,
I've looked at this a bunch. I don't know why I forgot. Has a real sense of movement to it.
Yep.
You know, just kind of like a kind of prismatic movement or something like that. I love his work, by the way. I follow him on art. What is it? Art Station or whatever. And
Kirk's the best.
It's a good way of telling what's being published because he does a lot of them, but he's also working with others too. So it's fun to see what he's doing. Hey man, I've taken up over an hour of your time.
I know. I'm sorry. It's my fault. Like I just keep going.
You're so generous. I love it. This has been fun. So a lot of times you know, on this podcast, we'll talk about, you know, biblical stuff. And so it's fun to kind of stretch our legs a little bit on kind of these. I mean, I love sci-fi fantasy stuff, and I think that our listeners do. So we'll find out. If you get a huge bump in book sales, you know, like this week, I want to take credit for that.
Sole credit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thanks so much for being on, and maybe we'll do another one of these sometime. Maybe when the next World Collide. Do you have titles for the other World Collide books yet, or is
I do?
Still,
I don't think I'm allowed to say.
Not allowed
yet.
To say. Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for folks, let's do kind of like the landing pages and stuff. So for folks that want to subscribe to what you're doing, is it clinthall.com? I think, is that the best space?
Clinthall.com. Go to clinthall.com, and it's also easy to find me. I post mostly on Instagram, so just Clint Hall on there. I'm very easy to find. Yep.
And for books, you've got. Audio. I know you've got. Just tell me. Let me stop trying to tell you. You tell me what. Yeah. Where do you want to direct people for experiencing the books in various formats?
Yeah, you can buy my books pretty much anywhere that you buy books online. So Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. Obviously, the Enclave Publishing Store is a fantastic place to go. And every once in a while, they'll do a deal for like signed editions and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The books are Steel Fire from the Gods, which is my debut novel, Echo Nova, which is my second book, which is YA time travel, and then my upcoming book, Worlds Collide, releases on July 14th. All of those books are available in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. And then Steel Fire from the Gods is now out in paperback. I don't think the Echo Nova paperback is out quite yet, but it will be at some point pretty soon. So I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about that, but it's no big surprise.
Are they out in digital? Because I remember reading Echo. I read digital. Was it?
Yeah, hardcover, ebook, audiobook. Every Enclave release comes out in those three formats.
They do those three. Okay.
So, yep. Actually, I think a few exceptions. There's a few that may come out paperback first, but for the most part, hard book, ebook, audio.
Yeah. So, yeah. Very cool. Yep. So pretty much you can get it. If you just Google any of the words you've heard in this conversation,
that's right.
It'll probably drive you toward what you need to find. So I highly suggest the ones I've read so far. I highly suggest. I haven't finished the new book, but I'm excited about it. So I'm looking forward to it. Clint Hall, thank you so much for being on. And, I guess we will talk another time. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, I really appreciate it. We'll see you later. Thank you for having me on.